Today at Reader's Corner, Foreign Service Officer Peter Van Buren, author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People.
The State Department was given the task of reconstructing Iraq, didn't equip us with things like adult supervision, training, and a plan, and it didn't come off very well, and I document that in great detail. Unfortunately, the Inspector General for the military and for the State Department have documented waste, hundreds of millions of dollars at a time. More than the money was the chance, the opportunity to show the world that the invasion of 2003 was followed by something positive. What we really wasted was America's credibility in the Middle East.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Charged with building Iraq, would you spend taxpayers' money on a sports mural in Baghdad's most dangerous neighborhood to promote reconciliation through art? How about an isolated milk factory that cannot get its milk to market? Or a pastry class training women to open cafes on bombed-out streets without water or electricity? According to Peter Van Buren, we bought all these projects and more in the most expensive Hearts and Minds campaign since the Marshall Plan. Mr. Van Buren went to Iraq in 2009 to spend a year as a State Department Foreign Service officer, serving as team leader for two provincial reconstruction teams. His first book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, is his eyewitness account of the civilian side of the surge, what he calls a surreal and bollocks attempt to defeat terrorism and win over Iraqis by reconstructing the world we had just destroyed. Mr. Van Buren has served with the Foreign Service for over 23 years. He received a meritorious honor award for assistance to Americans following the Hanshin earthquake in Kobe, a superior honor award for helping an American rape victim in Japan, and another award for work in the tsunami relief efforts in Thailand. He joins us by phone today from Virginia. Peter Van Buren, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, we're delighted to have you. When did you first realize that your experience in Iraq was a book?
It was kind of an evolution. I arrived in Iraq, and my initial plan was to kind of keep my head down below the radar, get through my year, and get back home. What I found almost immediately is that I was witnessing extraordinary things. I was witnessing things that were in contrast to what I had read in the media and in the history before I arrived in Iraq. I was witnessing the United States making mistakes, and I realized something was going on. I started keeping notes, kind of a journal that evolved into emails home that eventually evolved into a manuscript that evolved into a book. It was kind of a slow motion process, but almost inevitable given what I was witnessing.
Given the waste and mismanagement your book uncovers, has Congress expressed any interest in pursuing what went wrong?
It's interesting, Bob. I've actually been invited up to the Hill twice. One was to have a lunch with Ron Paul, who turned out to be a very interesting guy, a person I'd known only through the media. But he invited me up for lunch, and we actually talked our way through the book, and he was extremely articulate, intelligent, and as you know, had been an opponent of the war from the very beginning. The other folks to invite me up were, in fact, staff members who work on the Senate side. The particular committee they work for, it's probably best not to mention this right now because the mechanics of these things can get kind of complicated when I'm still technically a federal employee. But they were very interested in what's in the book, not so much for the individual projects, because unfortunately the Inspector General for the military and for the State Department have documented waste far beyond the small-scale things that I did, hundreds of millions of dollars at a time. But what interested them and what I tried to do in the book was to take these smaller projects, illustrate the thinking process behind them, or maybe the lack of thought process behind them, and say, look, it didn't matter whether we were spending $20,000 or $100 million. The process was the same. The mistakes were the same. The things that we did wrong. It's just a matter of scale between the small things I did and the bigger things that were done in Iraq.
Now, you said technically a federal employee. What is your status right now, and does that have something to do with the fact that you wrote the book?
I haven't checked in yet this afternoon, so I can't give you an immediate update. But unfortunately, my employer of over two decades, the U.S. Department of State, is not very happy about the book that I wrote. The State Department was given the task of reconstructing Iraq and sent people like me out there to do the job. unfortunately didn't equip us with things like adult supervision, training, and a plan. And it didn't come off very well, and I document that in the book in great detail. The State Department's upset about this and is in the process of trying to get me fired. We enjoy something very similar to academic tenure in that they can't just kind of point a crooked finger at me and say, you're out of here, go away. And so it is a process, not an event. But I'm afraid that the State Department has currently suspended me and that they have also suspended my security clearance, allegedly because of a link, not a leak, a link on my blog, wementwell.com, to a document on the WikiLeaks site.
Now, in the conclusion to your book where you're making acknowledgments, you say, not thanks really, but a special notice to Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, who led an organization I once cared deeply for into a swamp and abandoned us there. In a sad way, their actions created this book. I just wrote it all down. You know, I remember Harry Truman, I think it was, a long time ago, made some reference. I think he's the guy that called the State Department the foggy bottom. And he said, and then Eisenhower came along later and said, I tell them to do this and do that, and nothing ever happens over there. Is it any shock that a secretary would not be able to infiltrate the layers and layers of bureaucracy in a large federal organization?
The State Department is an interesting place because we serve independent of politics. Unlike a lot of parts of Washington that change every 4 years when we get a new president, the State Department doesn't change its personnel. The Secretary of State does change and is a political appointee. Currently, of course, it's Hillary Clinton, who is very much a Democrat. But we, the workers, the people like me, the Foreign Service officers, serve under whatever president happens to be there. So there is a bit of a push and pull between the political expedience, and that's certainly what I'm referring to there with Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice sending the State Department off to war, between the political expedience and the, well, we'll put it in air quotes, the wisdom of the regular employees. We are here for the good guys, we're here for the bad guys, we're here for the good decisions, and we're here for the bad decisions. And we know that our responsibility is to maintain the foreign relations of the United States over time. We've been doing that pretty well for about 250 years, but it does mean occasionally friction with the political appointees who have short-term goals, who have political expedience, who have favors to pay off, and things like that. You saw that during the Vietnam War, and you certainly saw that during the Iraq War, where many in the rank and file, including myself, raised some very serious questions about why we were being sent out to the desert, what we were supposed to accomplish, and exactly how were we to maintain the rest of the relations with the other 270 countries out there when so many of our brothers and sisters were being sent off to war.
When you write about your experience in the provisional team, what I notice is the lack of leadership from on high, so to speak. That is, when I read what you say about how this all came about, one minute you're referring to the Army, the next minute it's the State Department. It doesn't appear as though there was any great coordination or grand strategy at the top that would help these agencies work together instead of at cross purposes.
Bob, if you think it was confusing on paper after a professional editor got her hands on it, try it in real life. We were sent out to do something. It wasn't very clear. I came to understand at the end of the day that really the only true purpose of us being out in Iraq, and as well as Afghanistan now, was to be there so someone could point to us and say, look, we're trying to do something to make up for the damage we did. We've got something going along the line in these hearts and minds. Everybody was working at cross purposes with one another, sometimes with good intentions, sometimes not good intentions. The Army, for example, outspent the State Department 10 to 1 in Iraq. And with that much money, they oftentimes were moving on their own trail without really paying much attention to the slow guy in the back who didn't really have much cash with him anyway. The State Department bounced around between short-term ideas, long-term goals, feel-good projects, propaganda projects, stuff that would photograph well. Whoops, we've got the Secretary of Agriculture is going to make a speech next week. We need some agriculture stuff right away. Oops, we've got a new ambassador for women's empowerment. We're switching gears, and now we're supposed to find projects that will empower women. we were faced with this constantly changing set of priorities, at the same time realizing that we lacked training and lacked the ability to really plan ourselves. A lot of times we ended up just making things up as we went along. There's a chapter in the book called Everyone Was Looking the Other Way, and that ends up summing up, I think, the way that supervision and leadership and management took place out there.
In many respects, your book is a cautionary tale about waste and mismanagement that can occur in wartime when efforts aren't properly planned and coordinated. You mentioned Afghanistan, and I have to ask, is there any reason to believe that the very same thing isn't going on right now in Afghanistan?
It absolutely is the same problem. Afghanistan right now has sucked up $70 billion of U.S. reconstruction money, and the work there is being done largely by the same people. Most of the contractors who worked on my provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq picked up and left and moved over to Afghanistan, where they're doing the same thing in the same way. The cast is the same, the script is the same, and so I'm going to suggest that the results will be the same. But I wanted to pick up on a point about waste. And in the book, I do spend a lot of time cataloging some of the sillier things we spent money on, and you highlighted some of my favorites at the top of the show here. And we certainly wasted a lot of money, $63 billion in Iraq. But what we wasted more than the money was the chance, the opportunity, the ability to actually show the world that we could do something positive, that the invasion of 2003, which was a terrible thing for Iraqis, was followed by something positive, a reconstruction of their country, a winning hearts and minds campaign that enhanced America's status. But I'm afraid we wasted that as well. And in the end of the day, while the dollars certainly count and certainly do matter, what we really wasted was America's credibility in the Middle East.
You're listening to Peter Van Buren. He is the author of We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Well, let's start with something that's more symbolic than anything else. But you have a chapter called The World's Largest Embassy, or The World's Biggest Embassy. And as I remember it, basically, the American embassy moved into where Saddam's palace was. Is that correct?
What must have been the worst public relations decision in the history of mankind, the American forces and the American State Department moved into Saddam's old places, the places where Saddam ruled from with an iron fist, we ruled from with an iron fist. The prisons that Saddam put his political prisoners, we put our political prisoners. It was a terrible decision to move into the so-called green zone, which was a nest of Saddam's palaces, and put ourselves literally on top of the throne where Saddam once sat. It made for a terrible set of public relations pictures, if you will, that we still are digging our way out of. The United States pretended that Iraq was a conquered country for a period of time until finally the death count on our side was so high that we had to finally admit that we needed to build a fortress in order to house our diplomats and run our occupation. And that's what we did. We built the world's largest embassy in the Green Zone at the cost of about $1 billion, literally the size of the Vatican. It has its own air force. It has its own $400 million inventory of vehicles. It literally can be seen from outer space. The embassy itself was symbolic of the fantasies of 2003. The initial architectural drawings, which are on display in the lobby, show that the images were supposed to be of grassy lawns and benches and people strolling around outside the same way you would probably see there at your university. The problem was is this was in the middle of the Iraqi desert, and there were not going to be any trees or any grassy areas or any benches for people to sit on. Even if it wasn't 120 degrees outside, the incoming mortar and rocket fire would chase anyone off the quad, no matter how dedicated a Frisbee player they might be.
But that wasn't going to stop the U.S. of A. from bringing in grass or sod, was it?
It was not. The United States continued to find different ways to create the ultimate allegory for the entire war. And our ambassador, who considers himself something of a sportsman, decided he was going to have grass in front of his embassy. There was a big central square that had been used for a long time as a helicopter landing zone, and he decided that he was going to have a lawn there. And he ordered seed and had tons and tons of water poured in, And birds came from all over Mesopotamia and ate that seed like it was an Al-Qaeda strike. The ambassador was not to be deterred by this, and he ordered somewhere between $2 and $5 million worth of sod to be brought by ship to Kuwait, put on armored convoys, trucked up from Kuwait to Baghdad, and laid down on his center square. Hundreds and hundreds of gallons of water a minute were poured into this so that green grass could grow in the middle of the Iraqi desert. But at the same time, imagine if you were in that embassy, your only view of Iraq is out your office window and you see green grass. How can you possibly understand the damage that we did to the country, the fact that most people in Iraq lack clean water, lack adequate medical care, lack adequate education? We didn't do any of those things, but we did put green grass down in our embassy. It is, in fact, the perfect allegory for the entire war.
And wasn't that part of your job? Weren't you sent over there to deal with the water and sewer issues with a team of people who I assume were expert in those areas?
We were the last of the people sent over to fix all these things. In 2003, the Coalition Provisional Authority, Paul Bremer's operation, tried to do it, and they failed. They gave it to the Army Corps of Engineers, who tried to do it for a year or two, and they failed. The big Army, the regular Army, tried to do it for a couple of years, and they failed. Money was then given to the international contracting firms like Bechtel and KBR, and they tried to do it and failed. So why not one kind of overweight, balding State Department guy and a couple of contractors? I'm sure they could fix it up. One of the things that made it very difficult is the so-called subject matter experts that I was given as my teammates were not particularly expert at much of anything. They hired people directly off their resumes without checking any background, without testing, without asking any questions, because they needed folks in such a hurry. And so people who had maybe served on their local town water board became the water and sewer experts. Anyone who would put a seed in the ground was an agricultural expert. A woman's gym teacher from California became our women's empowerment expert, and so forth. And so we didn't know what we were doing any more than anyone else did. We tried to make a little change here or there, but things like water systems, sewer systems, the electrical system, they're networks. And so by simply scattering our efforts and diluting our efforts, we in fact accomplished nothing.
What about the million-dollar chicken processing plant?
It was decided that we were going to change the way that the people in Iraq handled chicken. For about 5,000 years before the Americans arrived, the way it was done is that farmers raised chicken locally, brought the chickens live to the marketplace where they were sold. People took them home and kept them in the yard until it was time to eat. It was a pretty good solution for an area that lacked refrigeration and that didn't have a good logistics system to ship chicken around the country. This was not going to deter us from building a $2.58 million chicken processing plant in the middle of nowhere. It was our vision that the farmers were going to sell us the chicken instead of the markets. This very expensive pile of machinery was going to process the chicken so that it came out the other end, the end of the factory, not the end of the chicken. It came out the other end wrapped in styrofoam and plastic the same way you'd buy it at the Safeway. Now, it all seemed like a wonderful idea until you thought about it for more than about 3 seconds. One of the things that plagued all of our work in Iraq was that we never thought to the left or the right of our particular project. In this case, the chicken plant, it never occurred to us to think about how were we going to get the farmers to sell their live chickens to our factory? Where was that money going to come from? How were we going to disrupt the existing market system? More importantly, we never give any thought to what happens on the other side of the factory with this chicken coming out wrapped in plastic and styrofoam. Where were the refrigerated trucks that were going to bring it to market? Where were the markets that were going to be able to handle meat that would spoil in a day? Where were the logistics systems, the roads, the electricity? The point being that we gave it no thought whatsoever. We simply built our part and figured out the rest of it would either take care of itself or, more likely, we'd be distracted by a shiny object and move on to our next project.
You also tell us about how we spent tens of thousands of dollars translating American classic books into Arabic.
Who doesn't love the classics, Bob. Moby Dick, Anne of Green Gable, all those books that you didn't read back in high school honors English. We decided that the Iraqis would probably want to read those books, and so we had them translated into Arabic and put together in a package called My Arabic Library. That was brought to Iraq at enormous expense. Our version of it cost about $80,000 and had to be trucked overland from Jordan. And one day, this entire container full of books arrived, and I was given the unenviable task of figuring out what to do with them. The Iraqi school system, such as it was at that time, was barely functioning, and the parts of it that did function used a standardized curriculum. Nationwide curriculum that the Ministry of Education put out. Literacy rates in Iraq are also fairly low, which didn't help our campaign. The colonel who was in charge of the military base said, "Do not leave that stuff on my base. I'm not going to have it be a permanent memorial to your stupidity. Get rid of it." And so I ended up having to beg, bribe, cajole, and promise a school principal to take the books away. He did. We heard later he tried to sell them on the black market, didn't find a market for them, and ended up dumping them behind the school where, unless they've slid into the landfill or someone set fire to them, I'm sure they sit today.
You know, you referred to the traditional diplomat who might have been responsible for coming up with a policy like that as male, pale, and Yale. I thought that was a great line. Explain what you meant by that, and because it does imply a certain elitism, like someone from afar who doesn't really understand the culture of the country they're working in.
And this has always been a problem with the State Department, is this struggle against elitism. The Army, for its many good and bad points, is a very egalitarian system. People join the military from all walks of life, all sizes and shapes, colors, and what have you. The State Department, for most of its history, has drawn primarily from the population that we jokingly call male, pale, and Yale. Caucasian men who go to Ivy League schools and who have been brought up in a culture of privilege and elitism and bring that with them to their version of diplomacy. So the State Department has made some strides, but at our senior levels, the people who make the decisions, who create the policies that folks at my level enact, I don't think it was very practical, and I don't think the people that put these policies in place were very practical. And I think our nation, as well as the Iraqis, suffered because of it.
What were your interactions like with Iraqi citizens you met? How did they receive you?
One of the problems was, in fact, interacting with Iraqis. The situation was such that it was too dangerous for us to travel freely. For people in the embassy who lived in the green zone, they truly never met an Iraqi. In most cases, they spent their entire year inside the walls of the embassy. It was simply unsafe and impractical for them to travel. The Army had a joke, how does the embassy keep track of events in Iraq? From the roof. In my case, I was embedded with the military, and we were out on forward operating bases, and the forward part of that name gives you a clue about where we were located. But even then, and even though we were tasked with going out and interacting with the Iraqis, in order to travel safely, we had to move in armored vehicles with machine guns on the roof and armed soldiers hanging out the gun ports. I had to wear a helmet and body armor, the same as the soldiers did. And everywhere we went, we had to go with an armed posse to protect us. Even then, our arrivals had to be unscheduled so that nobody knew we were going to be there Thursday at 12 o'clock, so they couldn't plan against us. And we couldn't stay anywhere very long for fear that the bad guys would gather up and come chase us. We were, in that case, more like aliens descending from armored spaceships, where we'd pop into the Iraqis' world. Of course, none of us on the American side spoke any Arabic. I got 90 minutes of Arabic training before my assignment to Iraq. We descended from these armored spaceships dressed like soldiers, with soldiers. Translators would come along, and oftentimes were amateurs at that. We'd give the Iraqis some money. We'd tell them we wanted them to build a chicken plant or a patisserie or whatever, and then we'd run back to our bases before anyone shot at us or blew us up. It was as ineffectual as we could possibly be. We couldn't have done worse, really, without trying.
I don't know whether you would think this a good idea or a bad idea, but did you receive any kind of weapons training, and were you allowed to carry weapons yourself?
I was unarmed, and in many cases I was the only unarmed person in a given room. The Iraqis that we dealt with all carried weapons, and our soldiers carried weapons. I got an hour and a half worth of weapons training, familiarization it was called, before we went out. It was better that I was unarmed. It was one of the few gestures I could make to the Iraqis to show that I was trying to do something different than destroy their country. But given that I had to wear the body armor that the soldiers wore and the helmet that they wore and descend from these armored vehicles surrounded by the soldiers, I don't think the fact that I was unarmed made a very significant contribution to the hearts and minds image that we were trying to create.
Given the controversy that your book has stirred up, I do understand, though, that you actually ran this by the State Department. The State Department knew about your book in advance?
Yes and no. I have a feeling that they didn't read too carefully. A year ago, I followed the State Department's rules that required me to submit the manuscript for clearance. The State Department rules say that they have 30 days to review the manuscript, and at the end of 30 days, if they don't make any substantive comments, you're considered free to publish. And that's what happened. I suspect at that time they really didn't know who I was or care what I had done or pay much attention to it. It was probably looked over by some low-level person. That was the status that my book sat in for almost a year until this summer the Huffington Post picked up one of my blog pieces and republished it, and that caught everybody's attention and sent a sudden flurry of interest in my writing throughout the Department of State. It culminated on September 20th of this year when the State Department actually claimed to have found three bits of classified information in the book tucked away in a chapter called A Spooky Dinner. That recounts my dinner with some people from our intelligence services. We had dinner in one of Saddam's old palaces where they had actually secured his chinaware, his dishes, and his silverware, and we ate dinner off his stuff. And somebody at the State Department woke from their coma and said, "Oh, that talks about the CIA. You can't say that. It's classified information," and asked for three minor redactions. We refused, to myself and the publisher, refused to make the redactions, and the book that's available to people today is unredacted and will stay that way.
Well, it certainly sounds like you followed the rules, and it sounds like the State Department handled that situation like they handled so many of the examples you're bringing up in the book.
I'm afraid so. The thing is that the State Department has personnel all over the place that have blogs, write articles, even publish books. The difference is that my book crossed a line. The State Department is very much like the mafia in the sense that you don't talk about the family outside the family. And what I did in my book was talk about the family and the family's problems and all the little bits and pieces of gossip that the Mayo, Pale, and Yale people at State Department would prefer to keep inside the building and not have exposed to the public. And because of that, my book, my blog, and me have been singled out for extraordinary treatment and extraordinary punishment for something as basic and as simple as simply telling a story of what happened that anyone out there with me would have seen.
Well, Peter, we've run out of time, but I must tell you, and I think our listeners have figured it out by now, that your book it will not only upset and anger taxpayers, but you do it with such a sense of humor and a wit about you. It's obvious in the way you've responded to questions today, but I must say that at least that sense of humor must have helped you get through the situation over this.
There was no other way to do it, Bob. We were faced with such absurdities and layers of unreality that you either had to laugh about it or you'd come home with a nasty case of PTSD. I chose to laugh about it.
Exactly. And in the meantime, if you'd like to keep up with Peter Van Buren's work and his thoughts on this subject, you can go to wementwell.com, the name of the book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Peter Van Buren, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.